Thank you very much, Dr. Liu. I would ask our speakers to come to the front now so that we may have a question and answer session. My name is Mark Curtis. I'm an associate professor in McGill's Department of Natural Resource Sciences, and I'm particularly delighted to be helping to chair this session with my colleague, Dr. Raghavan. Just as we begin, what I would like to do is briefly summarize a few of these points, and in particular, taking into consideration the topic of this morning's session, I really want to be able for all of us in here to focus on biofuels, how they affect food security. Mr. Ablev started us off with a very telling statement, I think. Not many believe in biofuels anymore. And I'm sure that will be a matter for discussion here. He and the others presented information that I think provides some hope in biofuel production, and I think the sort of discussion we have this morning may help with that. This is a challenging topic. It's one that requires integrating knowledge across many fields. It's one that certainly concerns markets, it concerns economics, it concerns people at all levels, and it very much concerns environmental and social impacts. So we have had some of this addressed in our presentations. Dr. Ding asked us, does biofuel affect food price? And he responded himself, yes or no, it depends upon how you do it. And I think we want to keep this in mind. He talked about how to reduce price and scale up, and certainly the diversification of biofuel products, which is a matter that we ought to consider as well. Mr. DeFranca certainly, again, addressed the biofuel effect on food security, and he, as well as Mr. Ablev, brought out the point that regional differences are going to have to be brought into the equation, that not everywhere is perhaps suited to biofuel production, and that is something that we want to take into consideration as well. And then finally, Dr. Liu, talking about biofuel convergence technology, has given us other both technical and general insightful commentary. So with this in mind, I will invite speakers to comment and to ask questions. I think right now I see 8 people lined up, which is very promising. I would ask that each of you try to speak very clearly and to manage to perhaps just present a very short comment and a question rather than a whole series of questions so that everyone does have a turn. Thank you very much. May we begin at this side of the room, please.
Sure. My name is Victoria Chayune. I work at Health Canada. And I just wanted to thank everyone for the presentation on biofuels. It's very interesting. What I was initially struck with was the food versus fuel problem or dilemma in terms of land distribution and land use. And I was also struck by the image from the Russian representative presentation with the surplus and then the waste that resulted from that. And I was wondering if it's feasible economically and if it would be logical for countries that are entering the biofuel industry or production industry to use surpluses initially for biofuel production following, after they meet the demands, the consumption demands of the nation first as an entry point. Just a comment question.
Thank you very much for that very good question. Mr. Ablev, would you like to begin?
Yes. Definitely, Russia need to use or balance production and demand of grain, and production of biofuel is most logical step for that. And second, I mean, we have to face reality that most of the countries in the world will support their farmers. And production of biofuel in Russia is a second way, is a way not to pay them not to produce, but to pay them to produce something meaningful and help the world, actually. So, I mean, but definitely before expanding any idle land, you should use your surplus. And increase and yield will imminent. I mean, most advanced farmers use all technology from U.S., from Europe, from Canada as well, to increase the yield. So we don't have to throw additional idle land. We have enough land to increase harvest significantly.
Is there anyone else who wishes to comment, or shall we move on to the next question? Thank you, Mr. Ablev. May we take a question from this side of the room?
Yes. Douglas Headley. First of all, an observation. In long-term experiments in Western Canada, what we found was that soil organic matter declined substantially from about 1905 to 1939. The reason for that was that harvesting methodology took all of the straw off the field. It brought it to a central location for threshing. In 1939, for a whole series of reasons, we started using combines that left straw on the field. And we have seen our organic matters crawl upward over many, many years, peaking nearly to the levels of original soils in Western Canada. If we use the biomass from the stover or straw of our cereal grains, we will have no stover left for the organic matter in our soils. How do we overcome that problem if we use the organic matter left behind after we harvest crops, take that off and use it for biofuels?
I'm going to ask for a volunteer here. Yes, Mr. DeFranca.
Organic matter, particularly in the tropical soils, is probably the most important thing. And of course, that we have a series of experiments being carried out now on how to check, in fact, which amount of the straws that we can just leave in the field, in fact, to replace and even to increase the amount of organic matter, let me say, for the maize and any other cereal crop. In the case of sugarcane, it's not the same. We have, for example, from the Brazilian Northeast, areas where we grew sugarcane for the last 408 years in the same area. The sugarcane started to be grown there in 1520, and still today is being grown, and still today the organic matter amount is good enough, in fact, to have, in fact, the economical results. So, Dr. Douglas Handley came with a very important point, particularly for the tropical soils. Organic matter is not a joke, and we have to deal with very carefully.
Thank you. I think we have a more commentary here.
Yes. Thank you very much for your question. In fact, when we use the biomass for biofuel production, we should consume the organic matter returned to the soil. And as far as I know, some of the biomass conversion technology will be very good for the organic matter returned to the soil. For example, the fermented sludge of biogas production is a good fertilizer. And also the biomass pyrolysis and the gasification, the byproduct is biochar. Biochar can be used as a soil conditioner, which can enhance soil fertility and increase the soil yield, and also beneficial for the carbon dioxide secretion. That means the biochar can be returned to the soil and it will be fixed on the soil for more than 100 years. At this moment, there are a lot of concerns in the world. At this moment, I do research at Cornell University, Ithaca, USA. The Cornell University has done a lot of research work about biochar and soil conditioner. Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you very much. I think we would like to have a question from this side of the room now.
Well, I think it's fine. It was just following the presentation of Dr. Liu, Guillaume Pilon, PhD candidate in thermochemical conversions. It's exactly in the way that Dr. Liu mentioned, like biochar in the soil. In fact, the emphasis was put on the fact that pyrolysis would result in 70% of bio oil and the rest some gases and this biochar, but in fact we could enhance the productivity of biochar to enhance this production of biochar and to have all these advantages that Sir just mentioned. So biochar could be a good fertilizer, retain water more in the soil, stimulates the microorganisms growth. It contains also all the minerals present in the initial biomass, and it's also very great as a CO2 storage because of its really slow degradation compared to the initial biomass. That's why even of enhancing the 70% of bio oil from the biomass, we could even try to increase, and it's feasible. Like it's just a matter of in the reactor conditions, enhance the biochar formation, and have all these advantages.
I think Dr. Liu should be very pleased with your comment. Would you like to comment further, Dr. Liu?
Yes, thank you very much for your comments. You are true. In fact, we can optimize the pyrolysis process either for maximized bio oil production or biochar yield. And if you increase the temperature about 800 degrees centigrade, the main product will be gas. If you concentrate the pyrolysis temperature around 400 to 600 degrees centigrade, the main product will be bio oil. If you decrease the pyrolysis temperature around 300 to 400 degrees centigrade and increase the solid resin time and the vapor resin time, then the main product will be biochar. At this moment, we try to optimize both biochar production and bio oil production in order to use the biochar as a soil conditioner. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And now we'll move to the other side of the room again.
Hello, I'm Sam Blythe, and I'm here from the University of Guelph. Just continuing on the last two questions, with biochar being useful as a soil conditioner, how does that compare to the losses of soil productivity due to erosion or evaporation when it is no longer covered by the chaff and organic material left over from a crop, if that material is being taken away for biomass production of biofuels?
I, again, am going to ask for a volunteer here. Dr. Liu, Dr. Ding, Mr. Ablev?
Just like a broad comment, this problem is, as physics used to mention, that's the kind of the second smallest after some other primary problems. So I believe that's not really so extremely important in the biomass production. And in addition, final goal of second generation, for example, ethanol from biomass is to use perennial grasses and fast-rotated crops like willow or aspen. And in this case, you basically cut the tops, but all the root system is there to prevent all this problem you just mentioned. And moreover, all nutrition for perennial grasses often go down to roots during the winter when it will be harvested. So it's a lot of nutrition will be stored under, I mean, in the ground.
I think we have time for a little follow-up. Go ahead.
This may be true in countries which aren't facing the same issues of food security, such as, you know, Canada, Russia. But in, say, sub-Saharan Africa, where do they have the land mass to produce these fast-growing grasses or plants like willow without compromising their food sources and the productive soil that they need just to get by day to day?
I'm not an expert on this area, but I mean, and I'm more on the economic side. For example, to sell biofuel to, from Russia to Europe, you have duties, and I believe it's around significant duties, 20 cents per liter or something like that. And it's no duty for sub-Saharan Africa. So in this case, some loss of productivity due to the, you mentioned the problem, will compensate in economical way low duties for export markets.
Yes, I think we'll have to let that take care of it. Thank you very much. Over on this side again.
Dave Conley. What I wanted to talk about was the use of the offshore and the marine environment, because you can grow macroalgaes and use them for two things, biofuel being the end side, but you can use them to mop up a lot of the nutrients that are going down the rivers into the estuaries. And if you put them out there, you can soak up a lot of the nutrient. In fact, we've discussed projects looking at the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico due to the Mississippi dumping a tremendous burden of nutrients and other things out there. But so you can lock up those things and remove them from that ecosystem, then take those algaes, convert them into biofuels, but there's a lot of other applications to it. For example, Toyota is looking at using seaweeds to make the next generation of car bodies. And there's a fantastic opportunity here to get a number of paybacks from doing one simple thing, which is going into macro algae production. So I'm just wondering if any of you have thought of that side of things. You also get out of the food fuel thing because you're actually out of the land side into the water side. And any comment on that?
Would someone like to take this up, Mr. Ambliff?
I read this book, Biofuel Could Be, I mean, the gas about this stuff, and the answer is the simple answer, cost. The reason we don't know the ocean, I mean, we know moon better than ocean just because the cost to explore that. That is why it's absolutely almost no research deep enough to provide some background. And that's a good idea, but cost to explore that and to build something there, that's so astronomical, so I believe it will be not viable for the next 20 years. Yeah, that's a good idea if somebody would invest capital to do that, but nobody.
Thank you very much for future consideration as well, I'm sure. Over on this side, please.
Hello, my name's Felix von Geyer. I'm a sustainable development journalist, and I also lecture energy, power, and security in international relations at Concordia. I think by 2050 we have to increase food production by around 40 to 50% in any case to keep up with the anticipated population growth. And I'd expect that would also add to the water stress problems we currently have. If I think NASA have looked at the agricultural heartland of India, and much of the groundwater is really disappearing fast. China, I think in 15 years' time, the rivers won't even reach the sea. Brazil, climate change and Amazonian deforestation will probably start to make you more water stressed as well. I'm just wondering if you have any comments on how water would actually be a negative impact perhaps in the whole food security biofuels debate. And secondly, I'm just wondering, I'll just try and pick up the lucidity of my point perhaps. I think I probably lost it. Yeah, it currently takes about 10 calories of energy for every calorie of energy that food actually produces, and I'm wondering if you then actually use more food for biofuels, whether the energy intensity actually increases again.
So we have two questions here. Mr. DeFranco, please.
Clarification, so I mean 10 joule of energy to spend to produce a joule of energy in biofuel or in food?
In food.
Oh, okay. Yeah, thank you.
Go ahead, please.
So what I would like to comment on this is that let's go for the ethanol. In case of ethanol in Brazil today, for every unit of energy, we comes out with 9 units of energy. So, in fact, is something efficient, very efficient when you compare it, for example, with ethanol produced from other stuff. And in case of water, you are extremely right. It's not a joke. I know that the planet is moving with the high temperatures. And one of the things that you are working very heavily is on technology, particular biotechnology, in order to develop strains, varieties, hybrids adapted for higher temperature and less amount of water. The problem today is that in many cases, I mean most of the cases, we are not using properly the water that we have from the rain or from any irrigation system, and day by day, water is getting to a point that we have to get the highest possible yield for every unit of water.
Thank you very much. Thank you for that interesting question commentary as well. Could we have a question from this side of the room now?
Hi. My name is Megan Putnam. I've just graduated from civil engineering at Concordia University. While I'll respect all the information that you have presented, and we're here talking about food security, about poverty, about malnutrition, I'm wondering about what you think about hemp. I know it's incredibly nutritious. It has high protein and good fat content. It can be used for a number of other things like clothing, and building materials, and I've also heard that it can be used for fuel. So I'm just wondering what you think about that.
Who would like to take this on? Mr. Ablev.
Yes, quite a few research about different feedstock for cellulosic bioethanol and hemp is on the list. The problem, it's not so efficient in some areas compared, for example, with switchgrass or Miscanthus, so that's not a top on the list. And second, hemp has some political issue similar which we have with alcohol in Russia. So, and the combination of that, I believe it's probably interesting path, but it will be a type of research projects because, again, let's face the reality, politicians don't want to hear hemp. I say, guys, that's guys from Berkeley speaking or what? So, I mean, I heard the stories. In reality, so politician answer and the politician the same in Russia and in America, for example, and Russian don't want to hear about ethanol as a fuel, and the America politician don't want to hear about hemp as a feedstock.
Thank you. We have time for two more questions, and we have two more people waiting over on this side of the room, so please go ahead.
Hi, Kirk from Waterloo. I just have a question for the first three speakers. Both of you showed quite similar graphs about the food for fuel debate, and I think Mr. Ablev mentioned to being an economist, which is, I think, a good thing. But my question is with respect to what Mr. Adams said on Monday concerning jatropha production in Ghana. It seems that these aggregate analyses don't always get to the heart of the problem. And I'm just wondering if behind your economic numbers, if you guys actually have any experience on the ground in villages and communities in smaller areas that might be glossed over with the larger analyses.
Could we begin with Mr. Ablev and then see what the others have to say?
I have my lifetime destiny to be first everywhere, so it's my last name. I'm not really quite understand what was your question.
You're looking mainly at aggregate analysis, like all of the graphs were essentially for the international scale, and I'm wondering how you can bring that down to the local level, because food security is not just a national issue. It also deals with communities, it deals with provinces, with states. So I'm just wondering how you can reconcile what you see on an international level with what the situation on the ground is.
Simple example, let's graph with oil price and, for example, corn price. Oil, that's a New York Stock Exchange, corn, I believe, Chicago. But that's exactly the same graph shows in Russian. I mean, if we just don't have very good data for Russia, but if you find this data and picture, it will be the same. And the general trend is basically, yes, the same. And if you go down to the region level or even to the some specific, I believe, farmer level, again, that will be the same graph. So the prices of oil dropped, price of grain dropped. In Russia, as somebody mentioned before me, some specific, so it's a stickiness. So price of oil or gasoline or diesel is very eager to go high, but they stick on the top, don't want to drop, but price of grain is dropping very fast. So that's what I see on local level. But globally, I mean globally, the Russia size or in Russian region size, yes, this is all applicable. That's my comment.
Yes, Dr. Ding.
That's it. That's a good question. I mean, if you're thinking about it, this is the big problem. It's not just... you cannot use in one standard. You can use for every country because the country are different. So if you're thinking about the cost of the biofuels production, one of the big proportion actually coming from the feedstock itself is the transportation. It's actually from one place to another place. You know, it's for example, if you have suppliers in Russia, you have more corn grain can be used and for there's extra there. But you cannot actually move it from Russia to United States or to Canada to produce ethanol. It's too expensive to do that. And also, I would like to also comment on other questions talking about the land use for biofuels production. It's very different. You have to manage the land use wisely, because some places might be better to produce food, some place might be better to use for maybe energy plant, energy crop to for the biofuels production. You cannot actually use the same. There's many different kind of technologies available actually. So depends on the local environment or the local way to do the business. You have. You have to choose a different kind of way to do this. You know, make sure there's no, for example, I heard in China, there's absolutely no, if you want to produce biofuels from any kind of food source, it's even blocked in kind of research. So if you're going to research on this, it's not encouraged. So I think it's very important for the local government and for each country to realize there's different technology available. You have to manage your land and all your economy locally wisely. This is my view.
Have another comment.
I think we'll have to conclude on this question just now, if we may. And I had promised someone on the other side here that they would have the final question of the session. So would you please provide this for us, sir?
Yes, thank you. I'm Bonko from Nigeria. None of my questions really has to do with biofuels and as it relates to food security. I'm just wondering, what's the cost of production of a liter or a barrel of a biofuel for vehicle use compared to that from hydrocarbons? That's one. Two, is there any person in this hall here who uses a car that runs on a biofuel? I'm just interested. I've come all the way from across the rivers, the oceans, and if there's such one, I would like to see that kind of a car, just for so I can go back satisfied there. Thank you.
I would like to offer that question to any of you, Mr. DeFranca.
Look, about the okay. First, let me say something about the efficiency of the use of these biofuels in the cars. In Brazil today, for example, if you go to a pump and you buy petrol, you buy gasoline, 20%, 25% of that gasoline is ethanol. So we don't sell 100% gasoline except for the aviation industry. So, and we have a second pump that is 100% ethanol. Because in 2003, we had something that for me was quite a revolution, that was the flex fuel cars that enable one to buy gasoline or ethanol without any trouble and use, in fact, easily. And the ratio that you usually in Brazil to work is that the price of the ethanol in the pump has to be less than 70% of the gasoline. So if it is higher than 7%, it's better for you to use gasoline. But in most of the case, the price is lower. It's just about this that the consumer knows that, in fact, it's better for him to use it. And the other thing that I would like to point out is that this program to make ethanol, in fact, available for our car industry started in 1975. In 1975, in Brazil, we used to make 3,000 liters of ethanol per hectare per year. Today, we do 7,000 liters per hectare per year. So in these 34 years, we had, in fact, quite a nice gains in yield in field and in the industry, and you expect that in the next 20 years it can add around 25 to 30% of gains.
I'm afraid we will have to close the session now. I would like to thank all of the participants in this very interesting session and ask you to join me in applauding our speakers.